The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this, what I think is going to be a phenomenal session. The way it works is that we tee up a brief conversation for a little while, and then we're going to throw it out, obviously, to you folks. So, and the mic is right there in the center of the room. So we won't, you know, we'll have a little conversation up here, and then it's going to be as a big a conversation as we can make it in the time allotted. And I would love to allot just a little less time so we have time to run up and make part of this session the book signing, because the book is incredible. So welcome Boots Riley. You came in on the red eye. You're in the middle of your publicity tour for the film. How many people here have seen the movie? Okay, so you can spoil as much as you want.
I don't want to spoil it.
We've got an interesting situation because we get to talk about the process, we get to talk about what brought you here and to the film, and we get to talk about a little bit about the experience of what it's like to move from on the streets, in the workplace, organizing to what you've been doing for quite a while now, which is out there in the world promoting the movie. I'd love to hear a little bit about that. But mainly I want to talk about this movie. It is a movie about politics in Oakland, California, and it's not Black Panther, but I kind of want to talk about the fact that there are two movies this year that uncannily revolve around the Oakland experience.
Well, three movies.
What's the other one?
Blindspotting.
Ah, right, of course. Has that come out yet, though?
It comes out a couple weeks after.
A couple
ours.
Weeks out, yeah. But that was also at, that's David Diggs, right? That was at Sundance, too.
Yeah.
It's got rave reviews. But so far, two. One of which maybe some of you have seen so far, but two of which you will have seen by the end of tonight, and the third in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Did you ever reflect in the course of the run-up to the release of your movie on the presence of Black Panther and the differences that you found organically to find your way to your movie? I'm just interested.
In the differences of coming up with this movie than
yeah,
Black Panther?
Well, just a couple hundred million dollars difference.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Actually, you know, so I know Ryan. And although he's like 10 or 12 years younger than me, he's kind of been a mentor in the filmmaking process for me. And also the guy that he wrote the screenplay with was one of the advisors. So I kind of saw through, he was one of the advisors at the Sundance Labs. Mm. So I kind of saw them kind of going back and forth and not really knowing what was going on, but hearing notes about the script during their script writing process. So I didn't have any of that. So because I didn't, when I initially wrote the script, I didn't even know that it could get made. So there was a lot of freedom in that. Like, I knew that because of the music, I could get people to at least read it and it could be a thing in and of itself. Like, I wrote this screenplay. It'll never get made, but check it out, you know. And so I could kind of do what I wanted. I also, you know, I wasn't trying to get a job as a filmmaker. You know, I wanted to make this film or these other films that I have ideas for or whatever. It wasn't like, you know, I had to fit a bill. But yeah, I think that I would assume they had a lot of notes in there and a lot of going back and maybe, I don't know, doing stuff they didn't want to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, I assume some folks have seen Black Panther, and an incredible film, and also one that really makes explicit the kind of ideological complexities and contradictions of making that kind of pop culture. It's really almost about that at some point. And it does end in Oakland with some, you know, a very rich guy who's just bought some Oakland real estate, saying, "Hey, I'm going to open a community center here." But he's obviously not from Oakland; he's from some other place, right? So, you know, it's a really interesting synthesis of taking the, you know, the imagery and the spirit of Black Panther, like the actual Black Panthers, and trying to revive them and talk about what that legacy is, but also in the context of this massive industrial capitalist, you know, myth-making machine, right? With characters who you inherit from a medium that was dominated not by the people who are depicted in the movie.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, it's also about, I mean, and that because of that, it ends up being about who we show as the heroes, and who we show as the heroes also ends up saying what we think the problem, or what we think the problem in the world is. So, for instance, if you have a superhero whose powers are that they're strong and they could beat people up, well, you're saying it's not a systematic problem. You're saying the problem is, well, in the cases of like Batman and most superheroes, that poor people are running rampant and just doing whatever they want. We gotta beat their ass and keep them in place. So in my film, I wanted him to have a different superpower that represented a problem that I thought was in the world.
So this is not a spoiler because it's in the trailer.
Yeah.
His superpower is that he has an awesome white voice.
Yeah. Yeah, he's magically able to make his voice sound like it's overdubbed by David Cross. And it sounds overdubbed to the people around him.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering what problem that's solving.
Yeah. Well, it's I mean, the problem he's trying to navigate is the fact that, you know, it's a problem when people on the other end of the line know he's black.
Right.
So his individual solution to it is just to hide the fact that he's black with that voice. But I think through the course of the story, he finds other things.
I believe he does. But that, even that specific moment of recognition of what that problem is, and it's the full force of it congregating around kind of workforce productivity, right, and results on the floor, and the way in which management deals with how those results get made and happen, where he even gets the advice for it from. You know, there's another piece of it where you can extrapolate a bit and say, well, look, all of our identities now online, you know, look at all the bots with the Trump, all that kind of stuff. There's so many layers of technology and kind of voice technology, whatever, image and electronic technology that mediate now from the place where you have whatever you call that identity that's going to find you, or you find, to the ones that you're putting out there, right?
Yeah, you can pretend to be whoever you think you need to be. But funny enough, all of this technology has not solved racism. Actually, it's just made it more efficient.
Right.
Like, you know, Barbecue Becky can call the police very easily. Right? It's technology isn't making us more free, it's just making capitalism more efficient. And so we, you know, that's kind of the other thing that is in Black Panther, that it was not just in Black Panther, but in so many movies, whether they're superhero movies or other things, like we see all these inventions and it's the tech that changes our lives, but it really does, you know, and then we have all these discussions of, well, life is going to change when robots make everything. But, well, whether that happens or not, the thing is, you still have the same relationship between the people, and the technology is only going to make it happen even more, you know, make that same relationship happen. It's not going to, you know, we're not going to be able to, you know, invent our way out of capitalism.
Right. Yeah. And the idea of this technology itself allowing for a kind of algorithmic sphere that appears to be objective and is obviously pre-programmed in so many ways, mm-hmm. and programmed to become less and less objectively fair. You know, I mean, the kind of social sorting that goes on silently, you know,
and
I always point
out. We get fooled. I mean, mm-hmm. like even really smart people get fooled into feeling like everybody's talking about this thing and it feels kind of almost democratic, like, yeah. you know, these are the issues that people are talking about. This is what I should, because it comes down your feed and you think that it's because your friends are talking about it, but they've also thought that this is what everyone is talking about. And the ones that are talking about something else, you're not seeing. Okay. So we, you know, we even more, you know, whereas before if it was the news, there's a good group of discerning people that could say, well, that's just what the news is putting out. But now it's like, this is what everyone is concerned with. And it's more of a sway than I think media has had in the past.
Yeah, no, there's no question. And look, your film is going to enter into a flow now of an entertainment media. Mm-hmm. And part of that flow will be moving it into spaces, you know, not just simply the physical distribution space, but you're getting a really healthy theatrical release, which is so great. And then downstream, of course, from home video and then into the subscription video on demand, the Netflixes and the Apple iTunes and the Amazon Primes. And in those spaces, of course, you know, the algorithms are working precisely to create for you, the consumer, as consumer, this idea of this kind of infinite amount of choice, mm-hmm. but the actual economics of it are, of course, to make those choices as few as possible while you still think you're free to choose,
yeah.
right?
That's why it takes so long to figure out what you're gonna watch on Netflix. Because you got all these things that you don't wanna see.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, but the whole industry is to try to make that as thin a stream as possible from an investment point of view, right? To keep that illusion of choice going. And it's going to be really, have you noticed, and now because you've been since Sundance, at least my feed says that everybody is talking about Sorry to Bother You. So,
well, and that's that that's same algorithm trick, yeah. because, like, you know, doing independent music for a long time, I have different ways of getting to people that I know are more effective. I can't necessarily do it everywhere, but I can at least do it where I am. So if I go to Home Depot, at least a couple months ago when I thought everybody was talking about it, and say, hey, I got this movie, they're like, what, really? And I show them the trailer and they had never seen it before. But according to my feed, like, everybody knew about it. Then about less than a month ago, we did a showing in Dallas that Erykah Badu hosted, and she invited everybody. And I could tell from how people were interacting with the film that, wait a minute, you know, like, they haven't seen these jokes in the trailer. And then I did by show of hands, how many of you never even heard of this film before Badu invited you? It was 70% of the crowd. So it kind of tells you how all of that worked, because I would have thought that people had at least seen the trailer or heard of the movie before. So it's you know, you can kind of get in that bubble that is, you know, defined however it is, you know, mm-hmm. for the subject that you're talking about, either, you know, people that politically agree with you or the cool kids that yeah. look for what's new mm-hmm. and we think that everyone
yeah, that's
knows
my,
about
that's
it.
My set. Yeah. but it's interesting too, though, you know, in the course of the publicity campaign, and I'm just interested in your lived experience, you know, you were sitting down with people like, you know, for example, Terry Gross on mm-hmm. Fresh Air, that hotbed of national conscious, you know, stuff. So you're talking about things in your interviews that are probably not things that a lot of people, these folks, have been talking about when mm-hmm. they're interviewing people who are out there hyping their movie. And how has it been negotiating those spaces? I mean, what is it? And what do you have any tricks?
I don't know how to stop what I'm going to say, so I don't have to negotiate it. So. You know, if you say something in the right way, it seems like it's the right thing to say, and people don't challenge it. So, you know, what's interesting about this movie, we've done, you know, a lot of screenings. Thousands of people have seen it. And I, you know, nobody said, I really disagree with what this movie is all about. Nobody has. And it's not like we've been like getting a questionnaire to see if people agree with it beforehand. It's just, you know, I think the politics that are in this film, the stuff that I would talk about, are actually more in line with what average everyday people think than we think. I think sometimes we can get caught up in the lingo that people are or aren't using and decide that someone's on the other side or whatever. But it's not really representative of how folks feel. I mean, there was that study that came out last year I sent it to Anthony when I just as proof. But it was a right-wing think tank that was up in arms because they had done a study of 4,200 millennials, and one in two of them said that they would rather it be a socialist society. And so they were up in arms saying, we got to change the education system. Harvard had a similar study. You know, the point is that if that's what some millennials are saying, then obviously there's a group of them that would edit themselves and believe that but not say it. And then there's probably a lot of folks that are older than them that come from that would edit what they say about what they believe too. So, you know, it's always been, I've for a long time put forward that the media's job is to make you feel like you're the most radical person in the room. And, you know, that nobody else would agree with you. So, you know, you mitigate what you say based on that worldview of things. I mean, you think about movies, and for decades, they've edited out rebellion. Mm-hmm. Like, and some of it is thought about, like, oh, can I get this funded? This is my opinion, I don't know. But, and then some of it is just writers not interrogating themselves about the world that they're creating. A lot of times, the reason why I think writers slip into cliche, even, is because they're writing a world and it's really based on all the movies they've seen. It's not even based on their real life, you know, which is why, like, you don't have rebellion even though it's in your life, like it's in people's lives, and it's not, they don't even put it in the background or something. But then you do have the noontime cafe date, which I've never had, but I think it's very rare, but it's in every movie. Like, it's in independent and blockbuster movies, there's a noontime cafe date. And these things are like mysterious, you know, they exist. I'm sure someone has had them, but they can't be so much that they're in every movie, and it's because writers are just writing the world that they have in their head. Like, I've never been to Delhi, but I have a picture of it in my head. Like, of what people are wearing, what kind of vehicles are being, I've never been there. And that picture doesn't even come from documentaries. It comes from James Bond movies or something like that, probably along with all the other racist ideas that are in there. So, you know, imagine someone not caring about, you know, like where their goal wasn't like, okay, I have a goal in life that says that I should make sure that I'm writing something real, that then you might just not even think about that while you're writing that scene that happens in Delhi, or when you're writing your workplace comedy or whatever, you're not gonna put that stuff in there because your world is the world that that movies have created for you.
Mm. Yeah. I would say, though, that many of the screenwriters who write these movies are in the cafe at noon in their pajamas using the Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
It's kind of how we live.
Yeah.
When we're writing.
Yeah.
It's like hoping for a date, you know.
It's
like, this could happen if I just stay here and keep writing, pretending to write. Here's a question. We won't rehearse them, but I think there's so many experiences that you had as a musician, as an activist, as a human. Why a movie? Why this particular form, this genre, as that this particular step?
I have a lot of different histories, and so when I say one that pertains to whatever I'm talking about, then it seems really disparate from, you know, the other thing that I would say. But a lot of things have always been going on for me in my life. My grandmother ran the Oakland Ensemble Theater in the 70s and 80s. I wrote plays in high school, and my first time writing raps was because I was assigned to write East Side Story instead of West Side Story for East Oakland and have raps in there. And people didn't boo, so I was like, oh, maybe I can do this. And then I went to film school. That was like, I also was an organizer at that same time. Or involved in radical organizations and campaigns. And so, at first I looked at, I had been involved in this storefront theater group called Black Repertory Group in Berkeley that was at an actual storefront that like maybe only 40 people could fit in. And I looked at maybe doing that theater, but I thought 40 people at a time, I'm not gonna really get anywhere with my ideas that way, or even 200 or 300 people. So I went to film school at the time when Spike Lee was the thing. But I was at San Francisco State, and it was all experimental mainly and documentary. And at the before YouTube, I mean, experimental museums, and then as far as I knew, and then documentary, I don't know. You know, like, you get, like, sometimes we would get, I'd be in organizations, you get, oh, there's this doc, and you have a tape, and you gather 10 people together at your house to watch it. But, So I got a record deal while I was in film school, and just from being in the right place at the right time, meaning like every record label had to have a group from Oakland at that time. And that's just how they think, like, oh, this group was from Oakland, they sold a lot of records, we don't like music, but we do know that if you're from Oakland, you might sell records. So, you know, that's how we got a record deal.
So you use the same same logic to start the film career.
Yeah. So, I think I had always wanted to do film, and I had been involved in all our videos at various levels, which is much different. But I did, and honestly, I don't really remember anything useful from film school, except for that, you know, we were doing the Super 8 cameras, and, you know, just the idea of editing and doing something and making something. But I think most of my experience that was helpful was producing music.
Right.
You know, where you have, you know, with music is the same way. I don't know what I'm doing. And I'll have the bass player that people think is the best bass player in the world, the drummer who's not the best drummer in the world but thinks he is, and the guitar player who texts in all caps and has ADHD. And they may each know way more about music than I do. And they definitely know more about their instrument, but I have to have the vision. And I have to know how to communicate with each one of them to get the thing that I need them to contribute. And what that means is to get them to buy into the vision, to get them to see it and see how they can contribute and get what I want. And then I have to also know that the guitar player is always going to want a guitar solo, even if it ruins the song. And then I then have to be able to know when the bass player has a better bass lick than I had, and to attach my ego to the finished product than to these small things. And so all of those things really helped. And then, you know, nothing's harder than being in a, nothing about dealing with people is harder than being in a minivan for 10 hours with, when the, right after the guitar player and the keyboard player got into a 2-hour fist fight. And, you know, so.
That's so impressively long fist fight.
Yeah, oh yeah. If people are drunk, they don't get hurt and they don't really punch as hard as they think they are. So, and they don't stop. And they just keep starting back up, going around the block and starting back. Yeah, so yeah. It's, yeah.
Okay, got it. When we identify you as somebody who has identified and still does as an organizer, the title I believe that the ISO gave us today for this panel had something to do with organizing, is that right?
I've done it in different times in my life, but I think it's, again, like with, I don't know how to define that, but I usually am, the times when I've done that has been me dropping all the art stuff.
That you actually jumped to the conclusion of the question I was about to ask.
Yeah.
How does this relate? Like now that you're about to have the film launch, can you retrospectively look at its role, this particular piece of art, in the larger design of, here you are in Chicago, you flew in on the red eye to be at the conference. I mean, this is a big deal for us, but it's also says a lot about, you know, where your head still is at. You haven't.
Says a lot about Anthony pestering people.
But how does, I mean, it's the obnoxious grad school question. It was like, art, politics, organizing, or art? Are they relate to each other? But yeah, I'll ask it. Why not?
Well, art is communication. And I think just even on the artist side, if you're wanting to make good art, you better have something you're more passionate in about than making art. Doesn't matter whether that's like love, sex, whatever. You know, if you're like, I just really want to make great art, I don't know, you might be able to get away with it, you know, once or twice or whatever, but it's gonna, yeah, it's not, you need something to guide the aesthetic. Just from that, so you need to have some reason you're talking. Otherwise, it's like someone who really just wants to be a great talker and doesn't care about anything except for talking. Then they're going to be really good at the cadences and the vocabulary, and they're going to talk to you for a long time, or maybe just exactly the right amount that they figured out. But you're going to be annoyed with that, you know.
Yeah.
And so that the organizing or being involved with campaigns, I mean, to me it's all connected. It's like one reason for being involved with changing the world is to feel like you're part of the world, right? To feel connected to what's happening, to feel like you were here. Because, you know, there's ways to ignore stuff. I mean, it can happen to you and you could ignore it. You can be in prison and kind of have given up. You know, it doesn't really have to do with what level on the scale you're at. People can find ways to check out, but even then, I think the way to feel most engaged and most alive in my experiences, has been when you feel like you're having an effect on the world, and or that you're part of something with other people. And so, I mean, that being said, bringing it back to the movie, you learn that at the beginning, that that's something that our main character is concerned with. People find it in different ways, or people look for it in different places, right? But I think art also is supposed to be about reaching out and kind of saying something about the moment, or saying something to people, communicating in some way, and something that you can't do with words, right? So it also, you know, it feeds itself into itself into organizing and back and forth. Like, I think what we do is, if you're an organizer, can and or should be creative, because you have to figure out how to, you know, you don't want to just have like just these slogans you're saying to people. You need to figure out what the person's concerns are, what you have to offer that connects with what that person wants out of a movement or out of life. And it's all really connected. I think that, you know, someone could make their art communicating one-on-one if their passion is about something larger. I don't even remember what the question was.
You know what? I will say we're just partway through this thing, but I've already heard more on this from you here, like, that I've heard, like, five
much.
Panels. No. I mean, it's not, my head's exploding. Before we throw it out to you folks, just something you just said sparked something in my own thinking about the experience of seeing your film, and also even just the minimal preparation I did for this conversation. I got online and I started looking at, mainly most of the academic research is really about the call-in service centers. It's not about the calling out telemarketing. So interesting. But I did, you know, you come across this academic research and it's so depressing. And your movie is, in some ways, no spoiler, a little dystopian, for sure. But the stuff I was coming across was so interesting to me, too, because the way in which the logic of just, I would say, human resource extraction is articulated in this particular business, both on the calling into the service center, the call out, and the issues it raises. Things like, we all have these assumptions, you know, the idea of the kind of standard English, or the American English that gets spoken by the person who is on the other side of the phone when your, you know, dishwasher needs whatever it is you're calling about, right? And you have that thing like, where are they? I wonder where they are. Like, physically, are they in India? Mm-hmm. Are they here? Is it the American South or all that? Mm-hmm. And the way in which the English accented or de-accented English, however you want to call it, white English, gets mobilized by the managerial classes and these call centers around the world. But what I didn't realize was that the idea, I mean, most people here, I think we all know that the vast majority of these call centers are not in the United States, right? But that's wrong. It's only 12% of them are overseas. And call centers in the United States employ millions and millions and millions of people, and they are sites of just massive domestic exploitation as well. And that was a kind of a, wow, it's here. In other words, it's present. The idea of this as being somewhere else or somebody else doing it or on the other side, you know, is, mm-hmm. I think that's almost part of the myth that makes it work, right?
Hmm.
And then the other stuff I was reading was these crazy guys in Israel at Technion University who do all the stochastic modeling for making the call centers the most efficient possible. This is the mathematical modeling. You probably, like, here's the global constraint satisfaction page. But one of the things that they've come up with are these baseline formulae for evaluation according to, like, wait time of customer of certain kind versus the cost of actually hiring people who are working there. So they've in this particular model, they're assuming that the value of the wait minute is three times the value of the worker minute. right? And then they plug that into these incredible mathematical formulae. That was really sad. And like just so weird. So there's tons of this stuff. But that leads me to my last question before we throw it to you, which is like...
And this is what science is being used
this is
for.
Like, you know, so this is, but I really, I just, it's also beautiful. You can, I'll leave it here later if you want to look at the formula. They're just like my butt. But your film's also very joyous. There's an enormous amount of joy. I mean, the screening I was just at a couple weeks ago in Brooklyn, and you just, the joy was palpable. I'm just hyping the film. You guys got to go see it. How do those things work together? I mean, I'm looking at this and I'm just like,
Well, yeah. I mean, I think because I've heard people use the word dystopian with it, but I wouldn't use that. And maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But the for me, all our work has, you know, we've never been. Like I have some friends that make music that is specifically about being angry. And I never thought that that was something that moves people to do things. Just in my experiences as an organizer, I know that a lot of people would always understand what the problems were. You know, people, you know, they think that they're like, can even get annoyed. Like, okay, you're just saying this shit I know, right? But the idea is that people don't always they don't always see a way to change it. And that is, to me, the real question is how do, and so people do give up because they think there's no way to change it or get cynical in a lot of ways. And so I've always, and that vision of how to change it, in that vision of how to change it, a class analysis, an analysis of the system, of the economic system we're in, and where our power lies in that system, is key to that. And that changes, to me, that changes it from angry, which is, I don't know what the fuck to do, or like, I just have to show the people at the top that I don't like it, to optimistic, to I don't need to talk to them, I'm talking to you. And there's a way that we can there's something to do it. So you know, sometimes our music in the past has been some people have put like it's not political, you know, anymore, whatever. I mean, even getting beyond that idea of what's political and what's not, but what they mean is they think it's not revolutionary anymore because it's they identify certain chords, certain, you know, ways of being in the song that seem happy or seem you know, or it's about dancing or whatever. And to me, that's really what that's really that joy, that being there in the moment sort of feeling that we put in the music and then I tried to bring to the film. And so much of this film is about like connecting in the moment and then what's the extrapolating from that, what does that mean and how does that play out materially and as far as in your life and in movements and things like that. So, you know, that was intentional.
Well, it certainly worked for the audience I saw the movie with, including me, although just in defense of angry music, Rage Against the Machine, Killing in the Name of, I've lost 5 pounds as a result of that thing on the bike, and I'm gonna keep it on heavy rotation until I stay as angry as I can until I lose more.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just that, like it's, I think there's a lot of punk that is that way.
Yeah.
And that's, there are a lot of things that I connect to about punk, and that is not one of them that I politically connect to.
Yeah.
And I think it comes out of, I think it's, you know, and this is not through research or anything, but just observation that it's more connected to a political stance that says you can't actually change the system, and that it's, you know, connected to the idea that there shouldn't be organizations and that, all these things that lead you into this thing of, you know, that it's cool that you don't like everything or whatever, as opposed to that there's a plan to fulfill. And obviously I think there are people that's not for all of punk, but I'm saying there are some sorts of that, and it ends up just being a style, you know, and that's all you can go, anywhere you can go with it. And there's some, I take some pot shots at that in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in terms of Joy of Connection and the political power of it, it is our turn to ask you to make that connection and stand.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.